Welcome back. I'm Tarek, addict, alcoholic. We don't write inventory to find out about ourselves. We write inventory to face and be rid of the things that are blocking us from God. I was talking outside, and my man said, it's all about fear. And I do believe it's all about a fear. Because when I don't trust God, I rely on myself, and I have a track record that tells me self-reliance fails, but I go to it anyway. That's the insanity of it. And so I think there's a specific reason they put the fear inventory in between the resentment and in the conduct inventory. I don't call it sex inventory. I call it more of a conduct because the past few years I actually write about people of the same sex. You know, how am I conducting myself in some relationships? And I answer the questions, which Brandon's going to get into. Fear, resentments, a fear of not getting something I believe I need for security. I think what it comes down to. And then the gross misconduct in relationships is really driven by a fear of being alone. For me. Now, Brandon's experience might be a little bit different. Let's talk about fear. Notice the word fear bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, and the employer and the wife. This short word somehow touches every aspect of my life.
Bottom page 67.
It is an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of my existence is shot through with it. The word shot in 1939 meant that the thread was woven into the fabric in such a way that you didn't see where it started or where it ended. It was just shot through. That means you don't see it. You don't see your life is riddled. Your existence is riddled with fear. It sets in motion trains of circumstances which brought misfortune that we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we set the ball rolling? I did. Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to review our fears. They came from the fourth column of your inventory. You put them on paper, even though you have no resentment and connection with them at times. Ask yourself this question. Why do you have this fear? Is it because self-reliance fails? Self-reliance is as good as far as it goes, but it doesn't go far enough. Some of us have had great confidence, but it cannot fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was even worse. So is there perhaps a better way? We think so. For we're now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns. You know, they always talk about this play, the drama of life is going to come up in the fifth step, stage characters, or in the third step, the hereafter in this drama of life. And now they're talking about we're in the world to play the role that He assigns. You know what happens to us is I wake up in the morning and I have three roles that show up for me, three stage characters. I have the spiritual man who wants to pray and meditate. I've got the husband. And I've got the Father. They're the three voices I begin to hear first in the morning on those days. And I walk out into the day, and the first act of my play for that day is to engage my daughter. So I'm the Father. And then I engage my wife, and I'm the husband. And then I go to work, and I become the business owner, the program director. And then maybe I meet a sponsee after work and I become the sponsor. And then I am Mr. CA once I get to my home group. And then I come home and I'm back to being the father and the husband. But what happens is, let's say my wife does something that I believe pisses me off, right? She didn't clean up any of the dishes, right? Everything's got nasty crust all over it and it's sitting in the sink, hasn't been rinsed and is not in the dishwasher. And then my daughter does not pay me the right amount of attention in the morning. She's just watching TV and I'm just invisible to her. And so I carry those two exchanges into work, right? So now I'm sort of twisted like this as I'm getting to work. and one of my employees calls in for, he calls in sick. And so I have more responsibilities that day at work than I want. Right? And let's say I'm on autopilot this day. There's no consciousness of the presence of God. And by the time I get to my sponsee in the evening, he looks at me and says, "Are you okay?" Right? They see it. That's what happens to us. We cannot just operate in one act in the play. Something happens and we take the role into the next act. And so before you know it, you got seven stage characters showing up to one act. And they all got ideas about what needs to happen. That's what we're up against. This is why we drink and get high. Just to the extent that we do as we think God would have us do and humbly rely upon God, does God enable us to match calamity with serenity? We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, God demonstrates... I don't like the word let. Brandon touched on it earlier. How do I let the Creator do anything? So to me, it's not about letting. God just demonstrates through me what He can do. I ask God to remove my fear and direct my attention to what He would have me be. Once I commence to outgrow fear. This is a conditional prayer. God will remove my fear after I become a state of being where the fear cannot exist. That's the condition. A lot of people are like, "God, please remove my fear," and then we just sit around and we wait. It says, "God, remove my fear, direct my attention to what you would have me be, and let's move into that state of being." And then if the fear comes back, we use the prayer again and we move back into that state of being. I'm going to show you, this is the format that I just used this year to write inventory. I've actually used this the past couple of years. It's straight out of the book. The fear, why do I have the fear? How did I set the ball rolling? What perhaps is a better way? And so I'm going to share a piece of inventory, and then I'm going to turn it over to Brandon, and he will take us into the conduct inventory. So I took all my fears from my fourth column and I boiled them down to four basic fears that I'm struggling with. Looking bad, failure, God will not provide, and having no purpose. And so let's do the looking bad. So why do I have this fear? If I look bad, I will not be wanted or important. Others will think poorly of me and I will lose my sense of purpose. How did I set the ball rolling? I am overbearing when I strive to look good. I manipulate others to join my side so I appear to look good. I seek to be perfect, which leads to my belief that I am in control. What perhaps is a better way? Seek to be of service instead of looking good. Drop my attachment of looking good and being important. Be impeccable with my word. That's how I write inventory. Simple, to the point. You don't have that many fears. You see all the fears I listed up here? I mean, there's probably 20 of them. The reality is there's only a few basic root fears, and these are the ones that are eating my lunch right now. So let's look at God will not provide. Why do I have this fear? I think I have something to do with my existence. I forget that God is everything. I forget the great many blessings of my life, and especially the last 9 years. You know, God has provided everything I need for the 9 years straight, every single day. I got three hots on a cot every time. I don't have anything that I cannot handle, but my mind tells me God will not take care of me tomorrow. That's what we're up against. I don't trust the process. I don't trust that things will unfold as they should. I think I know what is best. So what perhaps is a better way? Let things unfold. Do my best. Don't make any assumptions. Trust God to unfold and not fight how things unfold, even if my path involves failure. If God is everything and failure shows up in my life, that means God is the failure. I'm failing because I'm supposed to learn something. That's the way I look at it. This is how we write the fear inventory. Short, to the point, what fears are eating your lunch. You can write about every single one if you want to, but it's the basic format we use is this one out right here. And so that is fear inventory.
And I want to feel compelled to hit a little bit more about how fear kind of showed up for me about a year and a half ago. I pray for freedom from financial insecurity. And I think, with my keen alcoholic mind, that freedom from financial insecurity is going to manifest itself in the form of a winning lottery ticket or some relative that I didn't know that existed in my life and magically show up. You know, just here's a bunch of money, right? That's how I think that freedom from financial insecurity is going to show up. It shows up a lot differently from that. What happens is that I get beat into a state of reasonableness to the point where I have no money, literally no money. And I'm forced to trust God to take care of it. And when I do that, God takes care of it. But I'm going to fight like hell until I get to that point. And one of the fear prayer that Tarek talked about at the bottom, at the last full paragraph on 68, the last part of it, we ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. So when I was experiencing this particular fear, I would say this prayer constantly. I could be on a ladder working on something and I would say, God, please remove my fear of my financial insecurity and direct my attention to what You would have me be. What is directing my attention to what You'd have me be show up like? It shows up like, hey, get off the ladder and call Alex about a job. Okay, climb down off the ladder. Hey, Alex, strange question. Do you have a job for me? Huh, never thought about hiring you. Let me think about it. Climb back on the ladder. Another thought. God, direct my attention, remove my fear of financial insecurity. Direct my attention to what You'd have me be. Call this person. Call that person. Through this action, I get a job. And through that action, financial insecurity is taken care of. But there's always a three-part process in our prayer life. And we'll talk more about this later on. But it's thought. I have to think of what I want. Word, I have to say out loud what I want to have happen. And then action. I have to do something. I can't pray for freedom from financial insecurity and sit here. I have to do something. I have to move on. And fear is really tricky for me because it shows up really weird in a lot of ways. Like, I wrote inventory a year and a half ago, and one of the fears that I had was that was a fear of submitting proposals to clients because they might be rejected or I might become be viewed as unprofessional. So what do I not do? I'm afraid of submitting proposals, so I'm not going to submit proposals. So what happens? My proposals aren't accepted and I look unprofessional. So the thing with fear is the thing that I don't want to have happen by taking no action always happens. 100% of the time. And I got a whole set of inventory up here that I can show you that. Okay, so fear sneaky. So, bottom of page 68. Now about sex. Many of us need an overhauling there. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It is so easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cries sex is the lust of a lower nature, a base necessity for creation. Then we have the voices that cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of our race are traceable to sex causes. They think we don't have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow a man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy with our sponsees. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? So, as Tarek said, this, after you've cleaned up some of your past and you're living in a spiritual way, hopefully you're not having to write a deep, detailed sex conduct every single inventory. You might have a couple items that crop up from certain people at work that you're having kind of some twisted thoughts about. But for the most part, the first pass through for me, the sex inventory kind of cleaned up most of my thinking as it relates to women. Now, so you could open this up after you've been sober for a little while of start looking at the principal relationships in your life. Who are the people closest to you? For me, it's my wife, my employer, my kids, maybe my parents, maybe my siblings. And I look at my conduct towards the people that are closest to me, maybe several people at work. And I review my own conduct over the past. Okay? In the second question on page 69, there's a series of questions. So if I'm looking at it, let's say I'm...
They're behind.
Oh, look at that. I'll stand up because I seem to pay attention when I stand up. There's these nine questions, and you can find them all in the middle paragraph on 69. Yeah, they're all in there. So where have I been selfish in this relationship? With my wife, with my girlfriend, with former girlfriends? Where have I been dishonest? Where have I been inconsiderate? Whom did I hurt? This is the one that I usually bust most of my sponsees up on. Because I cheated on this girl, and so I hurt her. How long were you in the relationship with her? 6 years. Oh. Did she have any family that got to know you? Oh yeah, we went on vacations together with her parents and brothers and sisters. Okay. And she's got two kids. Oh, okay. So you cheated on her. What happened? Well, she broke up with me. Okay, so you just hurt her. Yeah. Okay. So did her kids form a relationship with you at all? Yeah. Did they think you might become their dad? Yes. So did you harm them? Oh, yeah. Okay, so do you still talk to her parents on a regular basis? No. Well, did they like you? Yeah, they really liked me. They thought I was going to marry their daughter. Is it possible you hurt them? Oh, yeah. And you really start looking at this. Whom did we hurt? Expands. It touches so many people. And we're so selfish and self-centered that we're thinking that I just hurt this person. Oh, wait. Now, the girl that you cheated on with her, did she have a family? Yes. What happened? Well, they broke up. Oh. So they got a divorce. Yes. Okay. Does she have kids? Yes. Okay. So now we're starting to pick up this other pool of people. Okay? And then there's the kids. Then there's the kids' friends. And then there's all her girlfriends that have to listen to her bitch about you. Oh, shit. I'm a selfish, self-centered son of a bitch that wrecks the whole world with the actions that I take around sex. So when you really start looking at this around conduct, same thing happens. My drinking didn't hurt anybody. Just everybody that comes in contact with me or anybody that comes in contact with the people that I come in contact with. Huh. Interesting. Did I arouse jealousy? Did I arouse suspicion? Did I arouse bitterness? You know, one of the greatest instruments that you can use in sobriety is this thing called a dictionary. What does jealousy mean? What does suspicion mean? What does bitterness mean? Because I don't know if you're anything like me. I like to think I know what words mean. I like to think that I've got this incredible mind that knows everything. And it's funny because I look some of these words up and I realize, oh, they don't mean at all what I thought they meant. There's parts of it that are close, but not entirely. Where was I at fault? Oh. And then the dreaded, what should I have done instead? You know, the depth of what should I have done instead? And as it says in parentheses here, in the relationship, don't write, not gotten involved in the first place. Because if that's the case, then don't live. Don't be involved with anybody. Really sit down and look. Well, I guess I should have thought about how my actions maybe have a ripple effect on everybody. Maybe I should have thought about all the horrific consequences of what I was doing would affect everybody that I know and everybody that they know. Maybe I should have been honest and forthright. Maybe I should have, if I was really not interested in staying in the relationship, maybe I should have done the manly thing and just said, I need to get out of this relationship. But instead, I went and cheated on her so that she would break up with me so I wouldn't have to deal with it. Wow. Maybe that's what I should have done instead. So make sure that you are especially explicit with question 9, because you'll come back and refer to it when we get into the paragraph called the sex ideal, which Tarek is going to talk about.
Thanks, Brandon. So, in this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Is it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and help us live up to them. We remember always that our sex powers are God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask, we pray, God, what should we do about each specific matter? The right answer will come if I want it. God alone can judge my sex situation, but counsel with others is often desirable. We let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we are going to get drunk or high? Some people tell us so, but this is only a half truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have an honest desire to have God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and we will have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and the conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to get high or drink. We're not theorizing. These are facts out of our personal experience. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for the guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves and quiets the imperious or dominating urge when to yield would mean heartache. And so I recently wrote an ideal. So what happens is I've been working with a sane and sound ideal for my relationship with my wife for almost the entire time we've been together, which is 6 years. And what that means is when I go through inventory and I answer this question, what I should have done instead, these are the things that are in my ideal. This is the way I would love to show up on a regular basis. So, let's see here. What should I have done instead? I listen to Marcy with intent and I communicate without fear. My actions show her she's appreciated. I continue to value her ideas and thoughts. We deepen our relationship as intimate lovers and best friends. We set aside one night per month for a special evening together. I pull my weight around the house. I thank God for her and Callie every day. I invite her to let me know when I'm not meeting her needs in any of these areas. And so this is very similar to the one I wrote last year. And it's on my phone, and every 3 months, I will sit down with my wife, and I will pull out my ideal, and I ask her how I'm doing. And I'll tell you, about 4 months ago, I got a horrendous report card. Horrendous. I wasn't pulling my weight around the house. I had told her I was going to do more grocery shopping, and I was going to take Callie to school more often. Hadn't done any of that. Sometimes I tell her I'm listening, and I'm not listening, but I'm acting like I'm listening. So these were the things that were coming up. I told her we were going to set aside a night or two for date night, and it had been 2 months and we hadn't had a date night. I kept breaking my word to her. And if I didn't have this method of having a sane and sound ideal for how I want to be, I would have had nothing to reference. And so the same thing happens in a few months. I'm going to pull out my ideal. I'm going to say, look, this is how I want to be. She's aware of the ideal. And she gives me a report card. So I watch people all of the time. They write out a sane and sound ideal. They put it in their folder. They put the inventory up, and they never refer to it.
Or so, they don't write it.
Or they don't write it. But how do you practice something that's tucked away and collecting dust? You have to work with this ideal.
Well, and what Tarek just said about sharing that with somebody else, I know that there's resistance. Because the first, I know somebody, at least one person is resistant to that in this room. Because the first time he shared that concept with me, I was like, I'm not doing that. Because it's about accountability. It's like, wow, now I actually have to do what I say and not just say and then not do. And so, to me, the question again, how free do you want to be? How good do you want your relationships to be? Do you want to really love this person and stay with them the rest of your life? Or do you just want to use them as a buddy that gets a little bit of relief out of them every once in a while? It's up to you. Just be real about it. What do you want me to know?
A few things. So, you know, they're going to do a general review here of inventory. If you complete the resentment inventory, the fear inventory, and a sex inventory, you'll begin to see some things about yourself that are not okay, that you find objectionable. But this is just through a series of observations and by making a bunch of lists. So we got to go a step further because the book's going to tell us that a solitary self-appraisal is insufficient. But through the if you write inventory, it told us at the beginning of the chapter, at the beginning of inventory, a business that doesn't take regular inventory usually goes broke. A business that stays in inventory never opens the damn doors also goes broke. So yes, I write inventory about once a year. And I'm in my ninth year, and this is the ninth time I've written inventory. I've gone back to the first step 9 times. Why do I do that? Because I like the effect produced by it. But it also centers me. If I'm not centered in inventory at least once a year, that means I'm not centered in my life. And if I'm not centered in what's going on in my life, then I'm instead of experiencing my inventory on paper, I'm going to experience it in living color. And I will not be aware of it. And it will build up, and I'll be catching resentments like a fisherman. Oh, let's catch this one. Oh, let's put this one on my back. And here's the next one. Oh, on my back. Here's the next one. On my back. And before I know it, I am weighed down with incorrect judgments, with incorrect actions, with incorrect belief systems, and I can't even see any of it. Completely shut off from any conscious contact with my Creator. And if the book is true and resentments destroy more alcoholics and addicts than anything, how dangerous is that? So this is why I write inventory on a regular basis. Because I want greater awareness. That's what inventory does for me. I don't write inventory to manage my life. I see people do that. I see people that are inventory all the time. To me, I see people that want to understand. They want to manage their life. They want to feel better. This is my own judgment. Who knows if that's truly what's going on? This is what I see and this is what I perceive. Because inventory is about a catalyst for a spiritual experience. I want to get closer to God. There's something in the way. I write inventory so I can face it and be rid of it. This is why we write inventory. And it's important that we summarize this process for you, because I think some people in the room right now think that this is somewhat of a daunting task. It doesn't have to be. I was talking to a gentleman outside. If you balk at inventory, it has nothing to do with inventory. You're balking on inventory because you don't see the connection between writing inventory and dying the alcoholic death or dying the addict death. There's no connection there. So therefore, there's no need to write. There's no sense of importance or urgency. It's not inventory that you have the problem with. It's the first step. It's always a first step problem in any subsequent step. If you complete each step, the completion of that step does two things. It gives you access to the needed power to complete the next step, and it takes you deeper into the surrender of the first step.
So should I go through this and then you'll kind of wrap, seal up to five?
I did this.
Okay.
Yeah, we're here.
All right, so bottom of page 70. If we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality, their weakness and their potential for death. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We've begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill towards all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct, and we are willing to straighten out the past. In this book, you will read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you from Him. If you have already made a decision, an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. If you have already made a decision, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of glass about yourself. Because that's what it is. You're swallowing glass because it's uncomfortable when you're in the middle of it. And so now you need to go see the doctor about having those chunks of glass removed from you. And that comes through the mechanism that we call the fifth step. Do you want to dive into this or do you want to pause here?
No, I think we'll go for...
Let's go for another 10 minutes.
20 minutes.
All right, so this brings us to chapter 6, into action. Okay? So, having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? Well, why did we do it to begin with? Does anybody remember? Face and be rid of the things that are blocking us from God and those about us, right? That's why we did it. So we've been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. We have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are going to be magically cast out. This requires action on our part, which, when completed, will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. This is perhaps difficult because I still want you guys to see me for who I am. Who I think I am, actually, not who I really am. And so, like Tarek said earlier, you know, after listening to enough fifth steps, it's so funny to me because it's like everybody that's writing the fourth step thinks that their shit is like the most immense mountain of shit that can never be overcome ever. And when I listen to enough of it, it all generally sounds the same. And I can sense that while the person's reading it to me, that it's a big deal to them, and I'm listening going, oh, I do that shit. And so there's so many times where I listen to a fifth step where the other person walks away having a sense of relief from sharing it, and I'm walking away going, I got some more work to do. I'm starting to realize that this person was put in my life to show me that I'm a complete turd in these areas of my life and that I need to really work on them. And so another one of those magical things that sponsorship does that nobody tells you about is that it shines a light on the way that you look at it. So when I'm discussing the defect with this is difficult, especially discussing it with another person. We think we have done well enough by admitting these things to ourselves, but there is doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Why? Because I'm a liar, and I'm going to lie, and I'm going to make it seem like it's not as bad as it really is. Many of us thought it was necessary to go much further. And we will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reason why to do so. The first reason, if we skip this vital step, which means life-giving, we may not overcome drinking and drugging. Time after time, after time after time, after time after time, we have seen newcomers try to keep certain facts about themselves to themselves, trying to avoid the humbling experience. They have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wonder why they fell. We think the reason is that they never completed the house cleaning, that they took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves. But they had not learned enough humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense that it was necessary until they told someone else all their life story. Right here is where treatment centers talk about life stories. Write out your whole life story. Let's be clear. When they're talking about our life story on page 73, they're referring to the three inventories that we did in the fourth step that clearly identify what is going on inside of my head. It is not about I was born on February 2nd, 1974, and so on and so forth, and I moved here, and I did this, and I did that, and I did that, and I did that. It is not about that. It is about going back through my life and being entirely honest with somebody else. More than most people, the alcoholic and addict leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. So, I may show up, I may dress nice, I may look good, I may talk in a soft way so that you think I'm this gentle person. I walk in the house and I kick the dog and I yell at the wife and I throw shit across the room at the kids. That's the double life. The inconsistency is made worse by the things I do on my spree. And I'm revolted at some of these episodes I vaguely remember. I don't want to share this with anybody. Because, again, it's going to make me look bad to you, and I need you to approve of me so that I can exist. Then it talks about psychologists are inclined to agree with us because we're never honest. But page 73, the bottom, we must be entirely honest with somebody if we are to expect to live long and happily in this world. Rightly and naturally, we think well before choosing the person or persons with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. So it says person or persons. In our group that we're a part of, we read inventory to multiple people. I will tell you why I do this. Tarek can tell you why he does it. If you think this is the only place that it references this in this book, if you go to the third paragraph on page 94, it also says that he may rebel at the thought of a drastic house cleaning which requires discussion with other people. Other people, more than one, not just one. So I'm going to read this inventory to multiple people. The reason why I do it is that as I read inventory to Tarek, I present the inventory to him. I am as honest as I possibly can be with Tarek. I am not trying to hide it because I know that Tarek doesn't really give a shit about what's going on in my life in terms of the details of what's going on in my head. Tarek has one thing concern. He has one concern with me at all. Is that I advance spiritually and that I'm free and I can experience God. He doesn't care about the details that's going on. So he's not really looking at what I really did. He may laugh at some of it and go, damn. But that's because we have that kind of relationship. I don't do that with new guys. But he has spiritual consent to me where he can just kind of laugh and see how I think. And I'm as honest with him as I can be. And then he gives me some considerations and I go and I read it to another guy. And that next guy I'm reading it to, as I'm reading it to the next guy, I'm remembering the way that I read it to Tarek, and I'm remembering the responses that I got out of Tarek, and so I'm kind of trying to shift things a little bit, and give a little different perspective on it so that I don't look as bad. And then he gives me some considerations, and I'm like, damn, he still caught me. And by the time I get to that third guy that I'm reading the inventory to, I can't remember what I told Tarek. I can't remember what the second guy I told was. So now I'm just reading inventory. Now I'm just reading what's on the paper, and I'm not giving any backstory or caring about what it says. And then, for me, the magic number seems to be around 3. After I've read it to 3, I can sit up here in front of you and read my inventory to you and not care. I don't care who knows about it. Unless it harms somebody because they hear what I said about them. But it's this transparency that you get by getting beat into this realization that I'm not honest with anybody. I'm trying like hell, but I can't do it. And so I have to read it to multiple people so that I can get to that place. Why don't you take over?
Thanks, Brandon. I did a fifth step last night. So I have very current experience. Brandon and I went back to the hotel, and I just, you know, I did a fifth step with my sponsor out in Colorado last weekend, I believe. And was it last weekend? I think so. Last Sunday, we used the computer, and so I read inventory to him, and I read to Brandon. And when I prayed about it this year, God said you need to read to 5 people. And I tried to ignore it, but it came back and said 5 people. So I've got 3 more people I need to read with, and I know who they are. And when I'm done, then I'll do this thing we call our returning home, which we're going to get into here in a minute. But the importance of reading multiple fifth steps is about authenticity. What Brandon described was a progression in his level of authenticity from the first to the last. It increases. We don't hide anything. Let's say I read the 5 people, like I'm going to. That's 5 people currently. They're going to know all of my current struggles. They know all of my limitations, and they know where I'm not conscious of the presence of God in my life. And it was really tough to read my inventory to him because I sponsor him. And it shed light on a lot of areas I don't want him to see into. But at the same time, it propels me into my desire to seek a deeper, meaningful experience with my Creator. Because I see how much I need my Creator after reading my inventory to Him last night. Because on my own, I cannot change that stuff. Otherwise, I would change it. And so we dig very deep in this aspect of the step work, because the more people that I can be real to, the less that I can be a phony to, right? Because the reality of it is, not everybody's going to like me, and I'm okay with that today. And that's really as a result of writing inventory and doing fist steps. But there was a day where I wanted everybody to like me. And it really mattered to me what you thought about me. It still does to a certain extent, but not nearly like 9 years ago. But if everybody likes me, then I can tell you I'm a phony. I'm a phony if everybody likes me. And I lived my life in such a way that I was a chameleon. I could hang out with the athletic kids at school. I could hang out with the nerds. I could hang out with the gothics. I could hang out with the punk rockers. I was like that. That was how I was. And I got along with everybody, and I had a stage character for everybody. One of my greatest fears that I would end up at a party and all those people would be there, and I'd have to make a decision of which stage character I was going to show up as. Right? Because I hid parts of myself from every group. Right? Running the show, arranging everything. What inventory and multiple fist steps have done for me is they've gotten me to a point where I am attempting to bring the same stage character everywhere I go. All right, same guy shows up at work, same guy shows up this weekend at the Bridges of Hope, the same guy shows up with Brandon when we're one-on-one. That's my goal. And that's what I believe multiple fist steps can do. You know, writing inventory is not about finding out who we are. Through the fist step, you find out who you're not. The combination of 4 and 5, you find out who you're not. And you know, one of my heroes, a man I mentioned last night, Don P, he talks about God being a sculptor. And he's constantly chipping away at us. Chipping. Through our struggles and through our darkness. That is God chipping away at us. And through inventory, we get to put pen to paper, and we get to use, God uses another human being to chip away at us. You're not the best father. You're not the best business owner, but you're not the worst. Right? So we become okay with being exactly how we are, and we quit this incessant need to change ourselves. Can we be okay with how we're showing up? And God is chipping away at us. And that really made sense to me. I really believe that's what inventory, one of the things inventory is about, to find out what's blocking me from God. One more. Nowhere does it say I write inventory to feel better. It does not say that. Go ahead.
And what inventory also does is it gives you that honest assessment of yourself, like Tarek said. I mean, there somebody can come up to me and say, dude, you are an asshole. And I can sit there and go, yeah, I am from time to time. I accept that. An inventory, if you do an inventory and you have do it with a fifth step, you can really start to get some freedom around like the 10th step that we'll talk about later. But I had an incident where when I was newly sober, the woman that I had children with, she sent me a text that told me, that said, you are a terrible husband. Not only were you a terrible husband, but you're a terrible father. Okay? Two statements, terrible husband, terrible father. Well, through the inventory process and looking at myself for who I am, I can look at that statement and say there's two statements there. Terrible husband, terrible father. Let's look at terrible husband. Okay. Have I been married? Who has all the world experience in this lifetime with being married to me? Well, she does. Okay. What is her perspective? Her perspective is you're a terrible husband. Going to have to go with that as the authority. Okay, terrible husband. What can I do about it? Right now, nothing. I can maybe, when I get into my next relationship, try to focus on that. Okay? honest assessment of myself. You're a terrible father. Let's look at that one. Well, when I was drinking, I would leave the kids at home and I would go get liquor and do all this stuff. Yeah, I was a terrible husband when I was or a terrible father when I was drinking. But when I got sober, I was more in touch with my kids. I was more into their life. I was more present to the moment. That when she says you're a terrible father, I can look at that and say, not true. There was no reason for me to argue with her. I had an honest assessment of myself through the inventory process to know that I am not a terrible father. Done. And if you really go in and you really do inventory, that process that I just explained to you doesn't take but a couple seconds. And you get to know who you really are, and you get to present who you really are to the rest of the world, knowing the reason why there's two of us up here is he's going to talk to some of you. And there's going to be a bunch of you that aren't going to like the way that he presents things. I'm going to talk to some of you, and some of you are going to like what I have to say. Some of you are going to be like, that guy's full of shit. And that's okay. We get that. But that's why the dynamic works, is because our personalities are different. And that's, we know that we're not going to reach every one of you, but that we hope that each one of us will reach some of you at a different level. An honest assessment of our abilities here. And that's what this, the fourth and the fifth step does for us.
Great.
So guys, we appreciate it. We're going to take a break here. It looks like we've got dinner coming up.